You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. And you know, sometimes I'm glad that I'm on radio and not on television, because if there was a video camera here in the studio and you saw what just happened, there would be a lot of people laughing. When you DJ with vinyl, the way God intended it, sometimes things go wrong. Dropped a record, bounced off one turntable, moved a needle off to the next. It was a lot worse than it sounded going out over the air, but we've recovered. I am your rocking attorney, Eric Jackson Lurie. And that last tune was Loudon Wainwright with his big hit from the mid-70s, Dead Skunk in the Middle of the Road, sending that out to one of the best people I know, my father-in-law, Big Al, going through some tough times right now. Hope that picks him up. Love you, Big Al. Before that, the latest from Ringo Starr, pressed on a 10-inch record. That was Everyone and Everything. Before that, bunch of requests tonight for the latest from Angel, Liar, Liar. New music from classic artists, that's what we're all about, and it's so much fun when things take off here at the station. And that album and the reunion of Angel certainly has. Very, very cool. And we open it all up with the Moody Blues. So you've heard that we lost Gordon Lightfoot, but what a great career of music, what a great collection of music, what a great discography he left us. We got a lot of requests for some popular songs, so we're going to play them, we're going to do them, but we're going to play some deep cuts, and we're going to start off, you know, as we say goodbye to Gordon Lightfoot. At the same time, with a little dedication, we're going to say hello to Baby Bo, just born today in Reserve Township. His dad's a Gordon Lightfoot fan. So let's kick it all off with The House That You Live In. Happy birthday, Baby Bo.
Go first in the world, go forth with your fears. Remember, a price must be paid. Be always too soon, be never too fast. The time when all bets must be laid. Beware of the darkness, be kind to your children. Remember the woman who waits. And the house you live in will never fall down if you pity the stranger. Stands at your gate. When you're caught by the gale and you're full under sail, beware of the dangers below. And the song that you sing should not be too sad, and be sure not to sing it too slow. You come in the face of all common disgraces and know what they're doing it for. The house you live in will never fall down if you pity the stranger who stands at your door. When you're out on the road and feeling quite lost, consider the burden of things. And he who is wise will not criticize when other men the game. Beware of strange faces in dark, dingy places. Be careful while bending the law. And the house you live in will never fall down if you pity the stranger who stands at your door. When you're down in the dumps and not ready Is it money or love? Is it learning to live? Or is it the mouth you must feed? Be known as a man who will always be candid on questions that do not relate. And the house you live in will never fall down if you pity the stranger who stands at the gate. The house you live in will never fall down if you pity the stranger who stands at the gate.
Get out old Dan's records. Get out old Dan's records. We will dance the whole night long. It's fun to play the old time songs. If old Dan could see us now, I know he'd be so proud. Bring out old Dan's records. Out old Dan's records. Bring out old Dan's records. We're all here, we've all got dates. We'll dance all night to the 78s. If old Dan could see us now, I know he'd be so proud. If old Dan was with us still, I know he'd come around. Get out old Dan's records. Dig out old Dan's records. Back to 1935, the fox trot, jitterbug and jive. If old Dan could see us now, I know he'd be so proud. Get out old Dan's records. Bring out old Dan's records. High above the fireplace, there's a smile on old Dan's face. If old Dan could see us now, I know he'd be so proud. If old Dan was with us still, I know he'd come around.
Picking up the pieces of my sweet shattered dream. I wonder how the old folks are tonight. Her name was Anne, and I'll be damned if I recall her face. She left me now knowing what to do. Carefree highway, let me slip away on you. Carefree highway, seen better days, the morning after blues, from my head down to my shoes. Carefree highway, let me slip away on you. Times I love best, I wonder if she'll ever do the same. Now the thing that I call living is just being satisfied with knowing I got no one left to blame. Carefree highway, I got to see you, my old flame. Carefree highway, you've seen better days, the morning after blue. Head down to my shoes. Carefree highway, let me slip away on you. Searching through the fragments of my dream shattered sleep, I wonder if the years have closed your mind. I guess it must be wanderlust or trying to get free from the good old faithful feeling we once knew. Carefree highway, let me slip away on you. Carefree highway, you've seen the better days, the morning after blues, and I head down to my shoes. Carefree highway, let me slip away on you. Let me slip away on you. Carefree highway, I got to see you, my old friend. Carefree highway, you've seen better days, the morning after blue, from my head down to my shoes. Carefree highway, let me slip away on you.
You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. This is Courts in Session. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Streams online at WRCT.org. WWRO, Kibler, California, 103.3 FM, Time Travel Radio. We're closing out tonight celebrating the great music left behind by Gordon Lightfoot and some great requests. That was Carefree Highway. Maybe I have to put that in the top 25 songs of mine of all time. I could play that on repeat on a 45, drive my wife crazy. That tune never gets old for me. So this final half hour of Courts in Session is brought to you by Attic Records, who joins you in supporting WRCT. Attic Records, located in Millvale, is open 7 days a week, providing new and used records and CDs, and where EJL got some of the Gordon Lightfoot 45s for tonight's show. From metal to reggae, hip-hop to doo-wop, and all stops in between, Attic Records has the hottest new releases and all the music you want. Family-owned and operated, Attic Records pays for quality-used records and CDs with no collection too big or small. You can visit Attic Records today or call them at 412-821-8484 and get the music you need. And if you're interested in underwriting for Courts in Session or any of the great shows here at WRCT, you can email pr@wrct.org for more information about promotional exchanges and other partnership opportunities. So I'm a lifelong Gordon Lightfoot fan, and that doesn't stop after tonight. But back in 1986, I think the record labels were trying to figure out, in a time of Duran Duran and Cyndi Lauper and R&B taking over the charts, how to sell albums for a guy with an acoustic guitar. So they gave Gordon Lightfoot a new producer. He was on a new label. He was on Warner Brothers. And they produced the heck out of him and added a whole lot of backing band and very different sound, but still good stuff, because Gordon Lightfoot didn't write any bad music. So from the album East of Midnight, this is one of my favorites. This is Stay Loose.
Of the kind that will not. that fashion. I have been a good man. I have loved it. I have lost. Ever after, I will be remembered in my fashion, in my way. There have been times I have seen the river. Touched the ground, saying prayers and touching wood.
Chippewa on down at the big lake they call Gitchagumi. The lake, it is said, never gives up her dead when the skies of November turn gloomy. With a load of iron ore, 26,000 tons more than the Edmund Fitzgerald weighed empty. That good ship and true was a bone to be chewed when the gales of November came early. The ship was the pride of the American side, coming back from some mill in Wisconsin. As the big freighters go, it was bigger than most, with a crew and good captain well seasoned. Concluding some terms with a couple of steel firms when they left fully loaded for Cleveland. Then later that night when the ship's bell rang, could it be the north wind they'd been feeling? The wind and the wires made a tattletale sound. Every man knew, as the captain did too, 'twas the witch of November come stealing. The dawn came late and the breakfast had to wait when the gales of November came slashing. When afternoon came, it was freezing rain in the face of a hurricane west wind. Thank you.
enough to feed you. At 7 p.m. a main hatchway gave in. He said, fellas, it's been good to know you.
You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. I'm your rocking attorney, thanking you so much for tuning in tonight. Closing out with the master, Gordon Lightfoot, one of Canada's finest, and of course, the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. You want to keep it right here. Coming up, we got DJ Addy with From the Basement. I know I'll be listening as I drive home tonight. Good music coming after Courts in Session. So we're going to close with the very last recordings of Gordon Lightfoot. 2020, he came out with an album called Solo. And that's what we're going to close the show with. I want to remind you to take care of each other, be kind to each other, and be proud to be American. Let's get back together next Thursday at 8. Good night, Pittsburgh.
They might have split up or they might have capsized. They may have
grown. It's so easy to live with no fear or deceit, but sometimes I think maybe I have skipped a beat. The road I chose was not all it should be, but sometimes it was oh so sweet. Sometimes I remember hearing raindrops fall, feeling my love breathing alongside of me. It ain't easy to live with no tears of regret, but sometimes it was oh so sweet. There's a room in my soul are at rest, the mention of which breeds only an empty nest. Oh, with the flow where society heals, but sometimes it was oh so sweet. Kneeling in my dream world, here close to the ground.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
Well, several things. I went to Sundance 3 years ago and for a class, a directed study, and I watched these films. These were hard films to watch, man. It was not the films you're going to see in the theaters. These independent filmmakers, and man, they deal with the tough issues, issues we like to turn away from. And so I wrote a paper, and I talked about how Dr. King used the camera in a similar way. He documented, he took advantage of the news cameras to document the violence during the civil rights movement and how critical that was to the success of the movement. And so I wrote that paper and wrote it for several, I wrote different versions for a couple of different journals, and then the Derek Chauvin trial. And when I saw the Derek Chauvin trial and how important the camera was to the getting the verdict that we got, and hearing the jurors talk about it afterwards, it was the camera, it was the video, it was the images. I said, okay, I gotta take this paper and expand it.
Phil Allen Jr., pastor, poet, storyteller, filmmaker, justice advocate, and author of The Prophetic Lens, The Camera and Blackmore Agency from MLK to Darnella Frazier, published by Fortress Press. The camera lens has been a potent tool for revealing the truth and guiding us towards just outcomes. For the African-American community, where the default has historically been one of presumed guilt rather than innocent until proven guilty, the capacity of the camera to act as a witness to injustice and help focus our country's attention on painful reality has been even more imperative. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. used news cameras as a means of exposing anti-black violence by white mobs in the 1950s and 60s. Darnella Frazier used her cell phone to record and post the murder of George Floyd in May 2020. I'm Johnny O. Henson Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, The Prophetic Lens with Phil Allen Jr. in Black America.
Yeah, and that's what I talk about in the book. It doesn't always guarantee justice. It also comes down to the interpreter. Who's interpreting the video? With Rodney King video, it was so new. It was something new. And so I don't know if we just weren't ready to see that image and make hard decisions as a country, as a nation, or the jury pool. I actually lived down the street from that courthouse in Simi Valley for a moment. So I know the demographics there. So while it doesn't guarantee justice, but it does do this. They go into the catalog, the historical archive, the catalog. And so there's a collective narrative that we have. We may not have every single verdict or result that we want, but there's a collective narrative that is going to be very hard. No matter how much people try, it's very difficult to now deny the injustice, the bigotry, right? And then what that does is it confronts people with the truth they don't want to see.
Had it not been for the camera, we would not have seen the battered body of Emmett Till, the Bloody Sunday protesters, Rodney King, and the inhumane murder of George Floyd. Seeing them have proven central to the protection of African-American bodies and the achievement of some measure of justice. In his book, The Prophetic Lens, Phil Allen Jr. illuminates the critical role that the camera has played in African-Americans' quest to achieve justice for racially motivated tragedies, particularly those that have happened at the hands of white people. The book also chronicles the use of the camera, particularly in film from Griffith, Birth of a Nation, to Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. In his narrative, Allen also exposes all cameras are not created equal. Did Derek Chauvin's body camera or those of nearby businesses, for instance, yield images of equal clarity and power as Darnella Frazier's cell phone did of George Floyd's death? And would there have been a civil rights movement and Black Lives Matter without the camera? Recently in Black America spoke with Phil Allen Jr. Before we get into the book, I want to talk to you first about you being the founder of the Racial Solidarity Project. Talk to us about that for a minute.
Sure. The Racial Solidarity Project, or RSP, I founded 2 years ago, last month. I actually stepped away from pastoring about a year and a half ago, and I wanted to continue to immerse myself in the work of anti-racism, justice advocacy, equity advocacy. And so RSP, we stand on four pillars of activism. One is justice and equity advocacy. This is where we do a lot of partnering in this area. So I find that there are people who are doing the work. They just don't have the resources. They don't have the platform. So rather than reinvent the wheel, we partner with organizations that are doing the work behind the scenes, like Green Line Housing Foundation here in Pasadena. They want to close the racial wealth gap through home ownership. So we want to partner. We're partnering with them. We just did a fundraiser to raise funds to get a family, black or brown family, into home ownership. We've also partnered with the Rodney King Foundation, my friend Laura King, to help scholarship black fathers who may not have the resources to take their kids, say, to Disneyland for a day, or to take them to Universal Studios for a day and just have a time of joy and happiness. So we've done things like that with them. The second pillar of activism is education. And this is where we have our cohorts, small groups. We had one earlier this year, and we're planning to have one or two next year. And we just take a group, black, white, Asian, what have you, through five or six sessions. At least that was the last cohort, five or six sessions. We may do more. And educating them on the history, the laws and policies, the implications of people say racism, but I like to say white supremacy. Racism is the fruit, it's the product, but white supremacy is the undergirding ideology, the root of it all. The third pillar is wellness. I think when we talk about people having to watch videos of George Floyd or Ahmaud Arbery or myself doing the research I do, it can take its toll on you mentally, emotionally, physically. And so wellness is I think it should be seen as activism and not just self-care or not just something that you do to feel better. It should be a form of activism, resisting the very institutions and things that are set up that actually tear us down. And with that, also, white folks need to focus on wellness so that they can actually engage in the conversation without being triggered, without being defensive, without getting upset. And so I think everyone can benefit from that as a form of activism so we can actually engage this subject matter. And lastly, the last pillar is borrowed from, inspired by Dr. King's beloved community concept, is community building. I think we have to fight for justice, but we also have to have a strategy, a vision, a plan of action towards building a new community, or else we're going to be fighting the same types of injustices and inequities a generation, two, three generations from now, because the community has not changed. So those are the four pillars of activism. We're still new. We're trying to build it out. We're trying to grow it and see what happens. Present a comprehensive approach to activism.
I understand. Talk to us about your first book. This is your second entree into literature. Talk to us about that first one.
My first book, Open Wounds, a story of racial tragedy, trauma, and redemption. It's a story about my grandfather, who was I never met because he was killed in 1953. When my father was 2 years old. And my grandfather was a Navy veteran. He was an amazing swimmer. He was a seaman. He worked for, I don't know the name of the company, but he worked on the sea. He was a fisherman, seaman, and got into an argument with his boss. I think he left the job. And then when he came back, he got shot. You know, two guys that worked with him, they set him up. They took him to a place called Goat Island down in South Carolina, right behind where my town is, Georgetown. There's a little small little area called Goat Island. And they took him over there, and his boss actually had a shotgun, pulled it out. He wrestled away from the men, very strong, very athletic man. And as he was diving into the water, he got shot in the back of the head. And on his death certificate to this day says accidental drowning, fell off the boat. And my grandma, so I talk about the tragedy and the trauma that my grandmother experienced. And that's the grandmother I knew. I knew a traumatized woman. I knew a stern, hard, tough woman. And her brothers, my uncles, said after that event, she was never the same. And my father, he was 2 years old when his dad was killed. And I told him recently, we had a conversation recently. He was grieving the death of his brother and his mother 6 months apart, few years ago. And I asked him, do you think you've been grieving your father's death? And he said, well, I don't know my father. I never knew my father. I said, that's my point. My father spiraled into drug addiction. He had violent temper. I grew up in a home with domestic violence. And when I found out what triggered that, when he was 9 years old, he found out how his father was killed. And my grandmother said he was never the same after that. So I wanted to tell that story and get people to understand that racism is not just a thing of the past. There's an effect intergenerationally in our community, and we need to address that on multiple levels.
As I mentioned earlier before this conversation started, Mr. Allen, that the book is more than about a camera and video footage. What led you to take on this undertaking?
Well, several things. I went to Sundance 3 years ago and for a class, a directed study, and I watched these films. These were hard films to watch, man. It was not the films you're going to see in the theaters. These are independent filmmakers. And, man, they deal with the tough issues, issues we like to turn away from. And so I wrote a paper, and I talked about how Dr. King used the camera in a similar way. He documented. He took advantage of the news cameras to document the violence during the civil rights movement and how critical that was to the success of the movement. And so I wrote that paper and wrote it for several. I wrote different versions for a couple of different journals. And then the Derek Chauvin trial. And when I saw the Derek Chauvin trial and how important the camera was to the getting the verdict that we got, and hearing the jurors talk about it afterwards, it was the camera, it was the video, it was the images. I said, okay, I got to take this paper and expand it and talk about how important the camera, how critical the camera has been to our movement, to our community, not just us, it's not exclusive to us, but it's been important for us.
I'm always interested and fascinated when people write books and how they began their particular story. Why was it important for you to begin your book talking about the letter that you wrote to your children?
The letter I wrote, that was the foreword.
Right.
That was Dr. Rodney Smith wrote that.
Okay.
I didn't write that.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Now you mentioned the camera, and since you've already touched on it, but you say all cameras are not created equal. Obviously there was Daniela Frazier's more up close and personal, but there were also two other cameras in the area that was focused on the whole scene itself. Talk to our audience about your definition of all cameras are not created equal.
Well, it starts with who has the camera. It starts there. There was body footage, body cam footage. There were surveillance footage on the buildings across the street, but they didn't capture what Daniela Frazier captured. So she positioned herself, and I give her so much credit for the resiliency to stand there and not turn away and not move on. But she held that camera, and she caught Chauvin's eyes. She caught Chauvin's posture. She caught George Floyd's voice crying for his mother, saying he can't breathe. She caught it all. Whereas the body cam footage, it was just there. But there was an intentionality with Daniela Frazier and her proximity to the event that other cameras didn't really capture. And if we look at film, I talk about this in the book as well. There's a couple of chapters on filmmaking where you have a Birth of a Nation, and the camera was used to perpetuate these oppressive, racist narratives about African Americans and glorifying Ku Klux Klan. Then you have an Oscar Michaud who soon responded, African American filmmaker who responded and wanted to present Black folks in a different light, more positive light, an empowering light. And then you fast forward to the John Singletons, the Gordon Parks, the Spike Lees, and the Ava DuVernays, where they're using the camera also in an empowering way, but also in a prophetic way to disrupt that narrative and create a more truthful, empowering, holistic narrative of Black folks, but also of America. And so that's what I mean by all cameras aren't the same. It starts with who has the camera, but also who's in charge of distributing the footage and interpreting it for us.
I'm glad you brought that up of who's in charge of the message. Now, we have video footage of George Floyd. We also have video footage of Kyle Rittenhouse. But we also had video footage of Rodney King. But those two video footage ended in different verdicts. Talk to us about those particular instances where the camera was involved in the trial of each individual, but there were different verdicts. People saw them differently than what other people saw.
Yeah, and that's what I talk about in the book. It doesn't always guarantee justice. It also comes down to the interpreter. Who's interpreting the video? With Rodney King video, it was so new. It was something new. And so I don't know if we just weren't ready to see that image and,
right,
and make hard decisions as a country, as a nation, or the jury pool. I actually lived down the street from that courthouse in Simi Valley for a moment. So I know the demographics there. So while it doesn't guarantee justice, but it does do this, they go into the catalog, the historical archives.
Gotcha.
The catalog. And so there's a collective narrative that we have. We may not have every single verdict or result that we want, but there's a collective narrative that is going to be very hard. No matter how much people try, it's very difficult to now deny the injustice, the bigotry. Right. And then what that does is it confronts people with the truth they don't want to see, but also invites people to now engage in. Now, let's look even deeper, because this is just what you're seeing on camera. So let's look even deeper. And we see that happening in some circles. We see more. I have more and more white folks that are now engaging, asking questions, not enough, but more than used to be, because they've been confronted with this image. Now they have to go back and look at the Rodney King video and reframe that.
Make a reassessment. I see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the catalog, the archives is also important too. That while this may not have happened for Rodney King and his family, what does happen is we continue, and hopefully we don't have to keep putting these images in this catalog. That's not the goal, but we do have them. We have them archived.
Ms. Allen, why do you think the larger society doesn't have a clue or unwilling to accept some of the atrocities that African-Americans face on a daily basis, even with the camera?
I believe there is a conscious and an unconscious allegiance to whiteness that people may not want to admit or even realize. There's this idolatry, this putting America on this false pedestal, American excellence, exceptionalism, benevolence, because we have these ideals that we don't live up to, mind you. But there are people who have this allegiance, because to criticize America is to criticize whiteness and vice versa, you know? And I believe that there is both an unconscious and a conscious allegiance to defending and protecting and preserving what people might believe is the ideal for humanity, which is whiteness, the standard. They don't want to reflect on that. And so because of that allegiance, anything that challenges that taints that has to be pushed back against.
Now, you also write in the book, as you alluded to in your answer here, is that it extends greater than that, because it extends to the biblical teaching, Christianity, as whiteness and being next to God. Talk to us about that.
So if we go back to, I mean, we can go back to antiquity, but if we go back to the beginning of this country's formation, there was this belief that whiteness was, or white people, Europeans, were ordained, were the superior race. This is an ideology that, again, goes back to the time of Plato and Aristotle and Rome and Greek empires, with this idea of whiter skin being more beautiful, more civil, more intelligent, higher character, truly the standard for humanity. And as a standard for humanity, ordained by God, touched by God. And with that came the responsibility of civilizing the rest of the world. And everyone else is, these people of color, particularly African Americans, are less than human. So this idea of white supremacy is born or developed and nurtured. But then there's also what I like to say, white sovereignty. It's one thing to believe that whiteness is the standard of beauty, intelligence, civility, what have you. It's another thing to assume the position of authority, to even define people groups, to even say that whiteness is the standard. That's white supremacy talks about quality of a thing, the quality of whiteness. White sovereignty is the authority of whiteness. And so this idea that white is next to God, even going looking at Jesus, the depiction of Jesus as European, that's not by accident. And so all that stuff is woven, going back to even the previous question of why people are so resistant, because all that stuff is woven into the American psyche, particularly the white American psyche. And when I say white, I'm not just talking about white people, but white thinking people, which can be African Americans, Asians, Latinos. Those people can fall into that category as well. But it's built into the fabric of this nation, the psyche of this, the collective psyche of this nation, how we've been conditioned to believe that whiteness is next to God, whiteness is ordained by God, whiteness is holier, more righteous than all others.
I found it interesting, particularly in chapter 2, the unveiling whiteness, unseen violators, when you talk about Black television programs, and this program is called In Black America. Why does that have to be a qualifier when it comes to, I guess, minority programs or minority issues, when the larger community doesn't have to make that distinction?
It goes back to the last question about the standard.
Okay.
You know, whether we're talking Black theology, Black mm-hmm. television, Black whatever, it assumes that, like this network, this station, or this show is only for Black people. But again, we've fallen into this pattern, historical pattern of having to identify, put these qualifiers. If it's white, then it's not the standard. It's not, but I actually start saying things like white theology. I started putting those qualifiers there as well. And people, again, it shocks people. It agitates people. It disrupts them. It's like, what do you mean? It's just TV. It's just a television show. It's just theology. And so I'm trying to disrupt that narrative and use language and try to recondition at least people in my circle to think differently, to think about these things as someone did for me.
I understand. Also, I found it interesting, and I have somewhat thoughts that you articulated in the book about what you're going to put on, depending on the time of day, the heck with what the weather's going to be like. But going into areas that you're familiar with, but someone that lives there, which I found just very asinine to a point that, well, if you see someone of color, I don't know this person in the neighborhood like you know everyone in the neighborhood in which you live in. This is crazy.
Yeah. And you know, it's a reality.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't understand that. They don't take it seriously. And they'll say things like, a lot of my white friends, some of my white friends will say things like, you know, just ignore those people.
Yeah, right.
And what they don't realize, it is a constant.
Mm-hmm.
I actually can't afford to ignore them.
Right, exactly.
I can't not afford to be mindful. I can't just go happy-go-lucky into certain spaces and not be mindful of sometimes how I'm presenting myself.
Exactly.
So when I do go running, I talk about in the book, when I go for a run, if it's, you know, cold or cool at night, I got to put something on my head. Well, I'm still thinking, I still remember years ago back in Maryland being pulled over, walking to a bus stop by a police officer because a white man in my neighborhood simply called the police because he didn't recognize a black guy with a knit hat, a hoodie and a knit hat.
And it's not funny. Yeah.
You know, and the way the cop pulled up on me, you would have thought that I had committed a crime.
I got you.
So my heart was racing. And then when I said to him, I said, so you're telling me, when he told me why he stopped, why he pulled me over, I said, so are you saying if I see a white guy in my neighborhood that I don't recognize, I can call the police and you're going to come and do the same thing? And he just simply handed me my driver's license back and said, have a good day, sir, and walked away. So I'm rattled and upset for the rest of the day. And so I'm mindful of that when I'm in spaces, anything is possible. And we saw what happened with the young man in New York in Central Park when the woman called the police
the
and he was
watcher.
Actually filming her. The bird watcher. He was actually filming. She still had the audacity to pretend that he was threatening
accosting
her.
Accosting her. Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
So imagine if he didn't have that camera with him.
It would probably more than likely been a different turn of events.
Different turn of events. And this, unfortunately, is the reality.
Ms. Allen, before we run out of time, I also found it gut-wrenching when you talked about my particular profession in the media and growing up. You grew up in Greenwood, South Carolina.
Georgetown,
excuse me. Mm-hmm. And there were some incidents in Charlotte that you were apprehensive of going there as a young man?
Yeah, in Charleston, South Carolina, our neighboring city, when I was a kid, I remember vividly the vast majority of the images I saw on the news were black men committing crimes. So they were their mugshots. And that's when you're bombarded with that. As a kid, I didn't know any better. I just assumed Charleston was dangerous, and it was dangerous because my people, young black men, were committing crimes and robbing people and shooting and stealing and whatnot. And so it took me, it wasn't all my life, but it took me some years to actually, when I started playing sports and we had to play teams in Charleston, and then you realize these guys are just like us. And I didn't think about it until years later, how I was conditioned to fear my own people in that city. And it wasn't any other city. It was just Charleston, because that's what the images from the media had been given to me. That's what was given to me. And that's how powerful, going back to your initial question about all cameras aren't equal. Who's controlling the camera and whose agenda is behind that?
When all is said and done, Mr. Allen, what do you want readers to come away with?
I want them to one, understand there's more to the black experience than what they see in the media, both good and bad. There's suffering and there's pain externally, internally, that they don't see, that they need to understand and respect and appreciate that about our experience. There's also a resiliency that they may not see because of imaging images that are presented to us through film and television and what have you. There's a resiliency there too, and there's a beauty there too. So number one, just being able to I want them to want to know the fullness of the Black experience, right? The other thing is I want them to, particularly my white brothers and sisters, I want them to want to know more.
Phil Allen Jr., pastor, poet, storyteller, filmmaker, justice advocate, and author of The Prophetic Lens, The Camera and Blackborn Agency from MLK to Darnella Frazier. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's americanarchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712.
with a million stars in the galaxy. But I'm floating with them, it's hard for me to see. I'm holding on to this dear earth as it spins around with me. With a million miles of odometry, and the moon like a goon staring back at me, I'm holding on to this dear earth with love and gravity. 60,000 feet up in the air, I can't wait to come down, drop down. I've been that fool, I let my fuel run low. Let my people know I'm on drop down, slicing through the stratosphere, twice the speed of sound. My life is moving under me before I touch the ground. 30,000 feet up in the air, I can't wait to get there. Drop down. The only thing I seem to see around, the sand in which you stand within my hand. Slicing through the stratosphere, twice the speed of sound. My life is moving under me before I touch the ground.